Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We have an awesome show for you this week. Lots of news to get to. We'll talk about some of the things we've been driving, including our long-term Toyota Sienna minivan. And let's see, we'll also talk some news. We'll talk about a little bit more about the Land Cruiser, an electric Defender. Is the FJ Cruiser coming back? And hey, maybe Mercedes is going back to V8s. So with that, I'll bring in Road Test Editor Zach Palmer. How are you?
I am great. I'm actually wearing my Land Cruiser Heritage Museum t-shirt right now.
Okay.
That I got at the Land Cruiser Museum. I know this is going to be a Toyota heavy show, so I thought I'd get in the mood for it right off the get-go. I'm doing great. How are you?
pretty good. Most of you who've been maybe listening to the show have noticed I've been a little nasally and stuff, but I think I'm finally past all of that, hopefully, and at least feeling pretty good. May still sound a little nasally, so hopefully the audio quality is a little bit better this week. So speaking of my nasal passages, the audio quality is always good. Shout out to our producer Eric Meyer, who does a great job making us sound good no matter our levels of health. You were at the Land Cruiser reveal. We've hit this pretty hard. So, if you're curious, it's retro, it's mid 55s for the price, tons of pictures, tons of details. It's a hybrid powertrain, four cylinder, actually turbo. You know the basics at this point, but Zach is one of the relatively few people who have seen this thing in real life. Is there something maybe like from your, reporting, if you will, on the ground, that people who are just looking at these stories on their phone would have missed? What's it like in real life?
Yeah, it looks really, really good in real life. The first time that I saw it, I hadn't seen any embargoed photos, didn't, know anything about it. I just walked into the room and saw it there and was like, whoa, this does not look like the Land Cruiser that I know. We're used to this massive three-row, sort of SUV-ish looking thing, but no, this thing looks more like a 4Runner, not quite Bronco or Wrangler aggressiveness as far as the chunky off-road style, but this looks like a serious off-roader, and it's a definite return to form of what we've seen from 40, 50 years ago from Land Cruisers, which I think is really, really neat. I think that the interior, especially of like the base one, if you had like the previous gen Land Cruiser, you're probably going to be stepping into something that's a bit of unfamiliar territory. You got cloth seats everywhere. You got manual seats. It feels on the cheaper side, to be honest, it looks durable, easy to clean. It is not this like luxurious Land Cruiser that costs $80,000-$90,000 anymore. That really comes off in person. Obviously that makes it a lot more accessible, which is really neat. Just like sitting in the cabin, I really, really like the whole layout. Toyota has gone heavy on in with all of the buttons and switches and dials in there. You won't have anybody complaining, oh, it's all touchscreen based, blah, blah, blah. No, this is old school, buttons everywhere. Really, really great visibility forward. I know that Toyota stressed that in their release about how they really pushed the pillars back and got them super upright so you could see out of it. And yeah, it feels like you're sitting in a bit of a glass bubble when you're in the driver's seat, which I think was really neat. That's a similar feeling as you get in something like a Wrangler or a Bronco with its very upright windows. So I think that it really hits all those points hard as far as, it's going to make off-roaders happy and a lot of traditionalists happy. Pretty much all really good impressions from that thing. And I guess like one final thing from seeing it in person, the rectangular headlights, I think, look way better than the rounds. And I think that most of us who like saw pictures of it like online also agree with that statement. But like having seen it in person, like I can confirm your biases. The rectangular fit the actual body style, like that super chunky body style, better. The rounds, they sort of look like fish out of water in there. And like it's cool that they're retro, and like you can look at that and then look over at like an FJ40 and be like, oh, okay, cool, interesting. But it just doesn't really fit the character of the car, I don't think, as well. So my two cents, I'd go with the rectangular ones. So, yeah.
That's kind of what my lean was when I saw both pictures initially. I haven't seen them in real life, obviously, but I kind of think, given that the vibe they went for was like the FJ62, that 80s, early 90s look, slapping on like the, you know, the earlier era circular headlights. While it's a nice callback, and I always like vintage throwback stuff, whether it's cars, whether it's, you know, throwback jerseys, I think it's a nice touch. I just tend to think holistically and for the era they're going for, I agree with you. I think it's a really good look. I also happen to really like that that era of off-roaders, specifically the Land Cruiser. So I'm excited to drive this thing. I think, you know, really to me, in addition to like obviously making it, you know, a very capable off-roader that's more the 4Runner, Bronco, Wrangler segment, Defender, is the price. You know, I mean, that to me really rethinks what this thing is. You know, you go from like the last Land Cruiser I drove was very dated, but it was still very, I would say, luxurious. You know, the leather, you sank right into it. It was really nice. It was big. It was three rows. For all intents and purposes, it was like a Navigator or Yukon competitor. This really rethinks it, takes it back to what it really has been. Historically, like even farther back. And I think I don't know, this thought came to me. It was kind of now or never. You know, the Land Cruiser has been like a luxurious LL Bean three row SUV thing for about 20, 30 years at this point. You know, you start to think at that point, that's what it really is. The last time it was really this rough and ready, you know, thing has been 35 years ago. You know, yes, the current models are very capable off-road, but if you just looked at it, that wasn't really the ethos. It wasn't like a Wrangler. So they're definitely doing something different here. And with the lesser expensive materials, as you sort of delicately put it, I forget exactly what you said, you know, that interior, those furnishings really changed the mission of what this is. So I'm excited. I think it makes it more accessible for a lot of people too. I'm really interested to drive this one because I really like the old one, but it also, in a lot of ways, like a $90,000 really outdated SUV, like it's not a great way to spend your money either. So,
yeah. And you know, I think that this is honestly going to be like the right car for more people than will even buy it. Like there are a lot of people who probably step into a Wrangler or a Bronco and they don't do the kind of off-roading that like a Wrangler or Bronco is very capable of. So something like this Land Cruiser for a similar price, which yeah, like Wranglers and Broncos, you can get those up to $55,000-$60,000 in a heartbeat these days. This car is probably going to suit you a whole lot better. And you know, you can make a similar argument for a Land Rover Defender. Those on the cheaper side are also, they're way more refined on road. They're way easier to drive and live with than a Wrangler or Bronco is. And I think that the Land Cruiser is just going to be that, but, you know, even cheaper and hopefully with all of the Toyota reliability and the efficiency of a hybrid powertrain. I guess that's my hot take. Like, more people should buy this thing than probably even will, because it's probably the right car for you if you're into that look and that feel and off-roading.
It's interesting because just what I kind of thought, and we'll get to this, I guess, right now, Toyota had their lineup, you know, a little more sorted. You know, you've got the 4Runner, and then at 55, you added this new Land Cruiser. Okay, that makes some sense. You get rid of this extremely expensive three-row SUV, which, not sure, you know, sales were dwindling. You know, you still have the Sequoia, and then you plop in the Grand Highlander, which I drove last week. We'll get to that here. It all sorts pretty nicely. Now we're also seeing some rumors that the FJ Cruiser might come back. We reported on this last week, and this would be sort of based on the Compact Cruiser EV concept, which I feel like I saw that at the New York Auto Show quite some time ago. So it's random. And I've seen they've done a couple versions of it too. So this is a little bit of a wrinkle here. I think you know, the direction they could take it would maybe be smaller. It looks like it would be electric. So again, this wouldn't be like we're going to bring back the FJ Cruiser and then compete with the Land Cruiser and the 4Runner, which was, when you think back 10 years ago, that was a really crowded lineup of random, somewhat old school off-road vehicles, to which I say, hell yeah. I guess this could work, right? I mean, especially if they do indeed make it electric, which again, we don't really know anything about it. This is kind of a report rumor, but that would make sense if you're trying to like disseminate and spread out these off-roaders into different buckets.
I agree. I think that, you know, an electric FJ Cruiser thing has a place in the lineup, especially obviously you've got the gas Land Cruiser that we just had here. So everybody can go get their old school off-roader. And now, you know, I mean, hopefully we have some sort of an electric FJ Cruiser replacement. I mean, it looks super rad. It has, you know, styling similar to what the Land Cruiser looks like, but even chunkier and even more aggressive looking. I presume it'll be just as capable off-road, because when Toyota makes an off-road vehicle, they don't hold back. And the fact that they are continuing to tease it, I mean, they obviously showed us that concept. Like you said, it's been a while at this point. So the fact that they're sort of throwing it up on a screen the same time they're throwing the new gas Land Cruiser out there is a good sign that it is in fact moving forward toward production. This will, you know, actually be a thing that we see one day on the roads. And, you know, I think that they probably need it too, because you can guarantee that everybody else is working on electric off-roaders in the same vein as that. Where exactly they price it is going to be a bit of a mystery, I feel. Like they could come in around the same place as a 4Runner, which I feel would probably be like a good place, you know, just sort of ride that $40,000 to $55,000 range. And then maybe, you know, like a higher trim, go all the way up into the Land Cruiser area and make it super nice, maybe like $60,000. But at its size, I feel like I don't want it much more expensive than that, just because it will be a smaller off-roader. Something in the vein of like maybe between like a two-door and four-door Wrangler size. I mean, I'm excited to see it, because obviously Toyota is just, you know, throwing as many off-roaders at the wall as they can right now. I mean, I really think that like that a Sequoia TRD Pro is sort of like a replacement for the last gen Land Cruiser that was super huge, luxurious, and whatnot, because that's what that thing is now. I mean, we still have the Lexus LX if you want super mega luxury with the body on frame vehicle. So you're really going to have your pick of the litter here soon, and it'll be electric, gas, whatever size you want it. Which is neat. Really, really neat to see.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, in addition to like thematically seeing off-roaders really get a lot of traction, pun intended, you're also seeing smaller vehicles. You know, the Maverick really showed off that there's a ton of opportunity for smaller vehicles that still have like a truck or SUV type of vibe. So if they did go small with this, I think that could be a really good move. Whether it's electric, hybrid could be a good play too. Toyota is a little bit farther along with some of their hybrid tech than they are with their electric powertrains. So that could be an interesting play. Actually, if you look at this teaser, there's another large full-size vehicle in the picture that we mentioned in our story in a scooter. We don't really know much about either of those, so we'll see. I don't know. That could be an electric replacement, as we sort of posit in our theories. You know, who knows, could that replace the Sequoia? I don't know, but it's another large SUV. And, you know, with things like the Kia EV9, with, you know, large SUVs from Volvo, certainly large all electric vehicles are going to be a thing, you know, big three row things. So more on that to come. So speaking of electric and off-roaders, now we can kind of bring that sandwich together and move over to Land Rover. We have a report out of Autocar, actually. Which is kind of interesting. Number of different threads to pull at here. This is kind of coming as, you know, Land Rover. It's going to be a baby Defender, is what our reporter Rodin Glahn calls it. And it'll be smaller. And this is part of the strategy to make Defender its own brand, as opposed to just the Land Rover Defender, which I'll just say that right off the top. I don't agree with that. I think they should keep the Land Rover name and still keep using it. They're still going to keep using it as this kind of overarching umbrella and still use it in some circumstances. But I still think it makes a lot of sense for all of their brands. It's a strong, strong name. I feel like this is one that in 10 years, a new CEO is going to come in and be like, yeah, that wasn't right. They're going to quietly start putting Land Rover back on things. So Baby Defender, sounds a little, it evokes the Evoke. Let's see how many bad puns I could get in here. That's kind of what it sounds like to me, though. So, and I mean, it would be under the same architecture as the Evoke, the Velar, the Disco Sport. So, sure, sounds good. I mean, this is essentially, it sounds like somewhat similar to what Toyota's going for. So, I mean, could be good. I mean, wait and see.
I mean, more vehicles that look like the current Defender out there, I'm not necessarily opposed to. We have the 90, the 110, the 130, so you can kind of get it in whatever body style you want. Yeah. Add electric versions of that, sure. You kind of really need to pad that lineup out if you want to have a whole Defender nameplate. You can't just have one out there. But this is sort of a growing trend. Just like take your most popular name and then just like slap it across everything. I know that there have been a million rumors about Chevy doing that with the Corvette. So, you know, if people want that brand cachet, this is a good way to cash in on it.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, I think there's every chance that you're also right that like, hey, maybe we shouldn't move away from this storied nameplate Land Rover. We shouldn't separate ourselves too much from it. There's been a lot of discussion going back and forth on like how will there be Land Rover logos on the car? Will there not? Is it just going to be a Defender? Will there be no Land Rover, you know, at all? And it's all confusing. And I feel a bit up in the air right now too, until they really start coming out with a car that is literally just called something without Land Rover in front of it. So long as the car is cool, I don't think it really bothers me too much about what they ultimately decide to call it.
This actually, it's kind of a throwback. I remember 10 years ago when I was at Auto Week, we had a piece. I don't remember if we actually ran it. I think we did. I remember editing it and thinking this is a little too boring. And it was talking about the stratification, the diversification of the Land Rover brand. And this is what they were even talking about doing then, was like Evoke was part of it more than you'd have like the Defender wasn't back yet. There was more like a Discovery kind of thing, the Range Rover portfolio. We've talked to Ryswick about this and he argues, yeah, all anybody does is say we're going to take the Defender or the Range Rover, so you don't really need the Land Rover, which fair. That being said, like, there's very few brands, and I don't even think Land Rover gets into that, where you can get away where it's like totally a one word thing where you don't need to like keep the rest. You know, you don't need to do like an SEO make model, the Land Rover Defender, you know, 110 when you're speaking. I don't speak in optimized terms, but for the web. But, you know, I mean, thinking aloud, it's kind of like, I don't know, it feels like a rough brand exercise. You know, people still call a Corvette the Chevy Corvette, Mustang, Ford Mustang. You know, people, Dodge Challenger rolls off the tongue, you know? Not that you don't know what a Challenger is, but I don't know. Anyways, we'll let the marketing people figure that one out. since we're talking small trucks here, let's jump over here to the Toyota Corolla-based small truck, which would be a Ford Maverick Fighter, and I think would make a ton of sense. I feel like we're doing a very similar story, just different versions and slightly different brands as we weave through this news section. But I think they should do this. I think it would make a ton of sense. I think, you know, as Ford has obviously demonstrated with the Maverick, people want something smaller. They don't really want a Focus. But say it's a truck that still kind of drives like a car, but looks like a truck and kind of feels like a truck. You know, this is what people would want. I think you could do a lot with the Corolla platform too. So I think that could make a lot of sense. Toyota's done a really good job of making things look like rugged, whether they are or not. Look at all the weird ways they've done to the RAV4 with some of those like off-road things. look over at Subaru, what they've done with like the Outback. So I think they should do this. You know, it could even be almost like a Baja kind of style thing or an El Camino. I don't know. I think this would be a good move for Toyota.
I agree. I mean, any OEM should be looking at the Ford Maverick right now and saying, how can I get a piece of this pie? Because it's so popular. People that have ordered it can't get their cars. The dealers are still charging crazy markup for all of them. And, you know, if anybody's positioned to take on a hybrid pickup truck project, it's probably Toyota, which now that the Tundra is a hybrid, the Tacoma is also offering a hybrid. They could, you know, use the Corolla hybrid powertrain, one of their prime powertrains, you know, any number of their very excellent and competent hybrid powertrains, and get great fuel economy, probably pretty good towing, and just great electric range from a plug-in, really great fuel economy from a pure hybrid. They could really come after Ford here, especially just, I feel a lot of people associate Toyota with smaller trucks more than they do the big trucks, obviously like F-150, Silverado, Ram. They own that market, but nothing sells better than a Tacoma in the midsize market. And so people know Toyota for smaller trucks, and if they can come out with something that, you know, is also a smaller truck, boom, right there. You know, they got, I feel that they could get instant market share and people would really like the thing. So yeah, I'm all for this idea. Make it like the Maverick. I don't know if I 100% agree with the El Camino style. I feel like you got to make this thing look like a truck. Make it look like a Maverick. Make it, you know, even maybe make something like a baby Tacoma, as far as styling goes, and you know, give it some off road chops, give it a TRD Sport or a Trail Hunter or whatever marketing brand you want to throw out there, but give it some off road chops and make it fun. So yeah, bring on the little Toyota hybrid truck.
So we're getting more smaller trucks from Toyota and one big one from Nissan, Dunzo. Titan is dead after this model year, apparently. We knew this was kind of happening, but it still was a bit of a surprise because they put out like sort of pricing and trims. What they didn't say was this is it. So then, you know, a lot of different, you know, journalists went out there and confirmed it. Car Scoops actually got a memo from, like an internal memo here, and production is going to end in 2024. This is in Canton, Mississippi. That's where they make it. And then that factory will transition to make EVs. Wow. I'm surprised, you know, I would say this, I'm surprised it's happening now as opposed to wringing it out for a couple of years. And I'm also, even though we like, I feel like we've talked about this, written stories about this, like we knew the Titan was on borrowed time. It still is a really big deal to kill off a nameplate like that and your full-size flagship pickup truck. So that being said, I mean, let's go down the rundown. Ford, Chevy, Ram, GMC, the Tundra is pretty good. It doesn't beat any of the Detroiters, but it's still pretty competitive. That's four or five, depending on how you count. Did I miss anybody? Nissan never got into that top six in the segment. You know, they made a credible offering when they did that kind of XD tweener model where it was like, I remember they called it like almost like a, not like an F-250 or an F-150. It was like a 200. It was like in the middle, which with a diesel, which I think may have been standard, it seemed like they were overthinking the problem, you know, like, okay, you're not really competitive. So let's offer something that doesn't appear anybody necessarily wants. So I don't know. You know, Titan's a fun truck to drive. Trucks are fun to drive, you know, in that sense. But that's all she wrote. I don't know what this means for Nissan Stadium and for the Titans. You know, what do you do? That was a great brand activation for them.
Maybe they
can go back and be the Oilers. Remember when they were the Houston Oilers?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Those great powder blue jerseys. I don't know.
Bring on the Tennessee Oilers. I don't know how much oil production they're pumping out of the ground there in Tennessee, but Yeah. No more Titan. It's funny you mentioned that XD. I was actually on the there was a first drive for the XD that I was on about I think it was for 2019, where they were doing a refresh of the XD, and it was honestly one of the more disappointing drives that I'd been on, because previous to that refresh they had the diesel engine. But they got rid of it, which was like its one like selling point. And then its towing capacity, despite it being like a medium duty, wasn't really much better than like what you could get with an F-150 or like a Silverado. It really didn't make much sense anymore, because it rode harshly, had like that super stiff chassis, but did not have the diesel towing capability. And I don't know, maybe that's just like a microcosm for the Titan in general, and that it didn't make sense for a lot of people to buy. Everybody that, I mean, it's probably the most loyal segments in the world, people buying their full-size pickups. And people never really became loyal to the Titan like they are to, you know. I mean, even Toyota has a lot of loyal customers with the Tundra. It may not, you know, sell to the scale of something like an F-150, but people love that truck. Yeah, people just never really caught on to the Titan. I know that we have some sales figures here. It looks like its best year was just over 50,000, which is like what Ford does with the F-150 in what, like a couple few weeks, something like that.
Yeah.
So that's what Nissan moves in a whole year. And last year they sold a whole of 15,000 of them. So that's not a good number at all. So I certainly understand why they are getting rid of it here. It's just not as competitive as it should be in this segment. Everybody has moved on to bigger and better things. And the Titan, I mean, if they really wanted it to get up there, they would have to do a massive overhaul, invest just stupid money into the vehicle. Yeah. And yeah, it looks like they're just not willing to do that, which, all right, sure. Go ahead and focus on EVs if that's where you want to put your money.
My guess is at some point somebody did like a cost analysis and they were like, what is it going to cost to make this thing maybe competitive? And let's just say it's $1 billion. And then they're like, okay, how much does it cost to kill the thing? Well, maybe 20 million or whatever to retool the plant, 100 million, say. So you kill it off, write off 100 million. You're 900, you know, in the positive, and you call it a day. You spend that money on EVs or something else. So, and like the other thing is, it wasn't like, hey, this was a competitive thing that needed investment. It was like, you know, literally no matter what they did, they were going to be in fifth or sixth place. There was just no path forward where you're like, oh, hey, just spend the money and this is going to work. It's like, it never worked. So, yeah. All right, let's close things out with a return to V8s, maybe. This is interesting. The Mercedes-AMG lineup. You know, this is another, you know, we saw this come out earlier this week. I think, you know, I just drove the straight six of the E53 AMG SUV, and I really liked it. So I don't necessarily think this is a must, but hey, it could happen. I'd be interested to see what... you know, which one it would be. These would be specifically for the sedans, for the C and E63, which is, you know, the more powerful versions, if you will. You know, I mean, I drove a few of those 6.3, 6.2, if you will, V8s back in the day. They were awesome. You know, I don't want to totally be like, you know, they should do this, because I feel like we're saying everything in this podcast should be like, yeah, do it, you know. Maybe I should be a naysayer here, but it's hard for me to say, yeah, don't do it. You know, you're going to find a way to do your electric vehicles. I'm driving one right now, the EQE SUV. It's all electric. It's awesome. It's powerful. It's beautiful. If you want to find a way to make some V8s, sure. Do it up, man.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely in response to a lot of negative, impressions of like the new C63S plug-in hybrid, that four cylinder. I think it's 672 horsepower out of a turbocharged four cylinder plus electric motor. Plus you have like 8 miles of electric range on a full battery. It's, It's a very weird vehicle, I guess. Yeah. It's not exactly good as a plug-in hybrid. It's extra heavy because of all the electric battery, electric motor, and everything that comes with it. I still haven't driven it yet. I cannot exactly speak to what it is, but I have read lots of reviews and spoken to people about it. And people don't necessarily care for it versus the one that just went away, which is the 4-liter twin turbo V8.
Yeah.
You know, obviously that thing sounded like a V8. It was pure muscle. There was no hybrid anything. It was a lot lighter than the current one. Obviously they went to the 4 cylinders for emissions reasons. Europe was like, hey, you guys need to make fewer emissions. And in city centers over there, it makes a lot of sense to run under electric power. So you save a lot of money doing that. And I think it's just straight up illegal. And in some places you have to have electric power. Now, all that said, like, obviously, like, the V8 is still emissions compliant and legal. Like, Mercedes is making the SL63 and the SL55. Those have V8s. Like, and the bigger Mercedes also have V8s. Like, the GLE 63 that has a V8. You know, their GLS 63. All those have V8s. Like, they can make it emissions compliant and possible. They just chose not to with, like, the new GLC 63 and C63. So I don't know, maybe people have shouted loud enough. And I all that said, like, this is a bit of a rumor mill report. I'm not just gonna take it for granted that this is in fact happening, because it would be like a massive swing around to, like, hey guys, this is our new 4-cylinder, this is the path forward, and then all of a sudden say, hey, actually, we're going back to the V8s. So I don't know. I mean, if they did go back to it, I got no problem with that. I love the 4-liter twin turbo V8s. At the same time, I drove, it was a 2020 CLA 45 with the same 4-cylinder as what they put in. I shouldn't say it's the same. It's very similar as what they put in the C63 here. I love that 4-cylinder. Made great noises. Was super responsive. Just crazy amounts of boost. It was a hilarious engine. Now, that's not to say that it's the same experience in the C63S that's out now, but I didn't exactly hate that. And, you know, it versus the V8, I don't know if I would be too mad about having that versus it. But I guess this is sort of a wait and see if Mercedes backtracks here. I certainly wouldn't mind a number of years more of V8s. So,
yeah.
If it happens, cool.
Yeah, I think if we're going to do it, now's the time, just because there's still plenty of V8s on sale. It wouldn't be that hard to sort of shoehorn this M177, that's the 4-liter, into these specific cars that I think would give, you know, the people who are looking for, you know, the car as opposed to getting like an AMG SUV. You know, I think you definitely want that dynamic that like a car offers you, as well as perhaps a V8. You know, maybe that's the mindset, and you're not willing to make that if you aren't just looking to drive some like high powered SUV. I always thought the plug-in hybrid was kind of a weird one too. I haven't driven it either, but like, it's super powerful. The specs are just insane, but it's still a 4-cylinder, which, you know, kind of boggles the mind a little bit when you look at it. So I mean, I don't know. There's a lot going on there. I think in some ways, like, it may have oversolved the problem. Like, you're trying to do battle with these different competitors from Audi and BMW, and then, you know, you knew you're going with a 4-cylinder. It's a plug-in hybrid. You know that's going to cause some dissonance. So, okay, let's make the specs just insane, you know? But it's not always the numbers. It's like, how does it feel, you know? You drive these cars because you want to drive them, not just to compare fantasy football numbers. So, yeah, I mean,
it's a great point there. You bring up BMW and Audi. Like, you can hop across the way, buy a BMW M3 with that 3-liter inline six that is just pure bliss. There's no hybrid anything going on there. You know, same with an Audi RS5. You get their twin turbo V6 that sounds gnarly, just pure thunder. I could totally see that being a problem for Mercedes. You got a lot of people that, you know, they'll buy these cars. You buy them a lot for the sound these days and the experience that comes with that awesome gas engine. If all you really care about is that straight line speed, you can go out and buy like a Tesla Model 3 Performance, and
yeah,
that'll beat all of those cars in a straight line. So Yeah, a lot of it is that experience.
I drove the BMW XM recently, which is a twin turbo V8, but it's also a hybrid. And, you know, again, that's a V8. I still had a lot of questions and a little bit of confusion. You know, there's just so much going on with that application that I was kind of like, yeah, I don't know about this, you know? And I know I've talked to a few other people who have driven it, who have sort of fallen on either side of me. I think Joel, who I traded cars with, our news editor, he also was like, wow, dude, there's a lot to process here. Ended up liking it. I've talked to Pras Subramanian, who works for Yahoo Finance and does review car reviews for them. And he was a little bit like, yeah, I don't know, man. There's just so much going on here. This is the right car for some people. But he was kind of like, but not for me. And that's kind of where I ended up landing too. And, you know, yeah. I mean, I tend to think that's kind of where Mercedes finds itself with these two specific AMGs. So, yeah, that is our news section. Let's go running through a couple of reviews, a couple of Toyotas, actually. You're in the Sienna. We're about to trade. I will get that tomorrow, and you could get in the six-figure Mercedes EQE, which talk about that on an upcoming podcast, but I'm really liking it. It's a lot of fun. Beautiful car, beautiful crossover. But tell me, what have you been doing in this minivan?
Yeah, so I have moved houses the past month. What better vehicle to do it in than a minivan, right? So I have basically stuffed this thing from floor to ceiling many times over, and you know, it's been nice having a massive cavernous area. One story I wrote here recently did bring some of the I guess less good parts to the forefront as well, but I guess you sort of see both the good and the bad when you're constantly using a vehicle like this. The load floor is unfortunately just not as flat as you might expect. Yeah. In a minivan, and you've probably seen that too, loading things in and out, like trying to get things over that third row that doesn't exactly settle down. There's a lot of hooks and just snags to get things caught on, just like a slight annoyance when you are trying to move a lot of things. You know, you got to crawl in there, you end up smashing yourself into a gully within the trunk, and it's sort of weird and awkward moving things in and out of that van versus, like, we had a long-term Chrysler Pacifica a while ago, and that thing had a perfectly flat floor, that's I don't know, it makes a huge difference when you got a lot of stuff moving in and out. It's a lot more efficient and easy to work with. So I don't know, I'll give the Sienna's cargo area probably like a good like 6.5 to 7 out of 10. Great score because, you know, it's huge, it's big, but it's just annoying to deal with in a lot of ways. The second row seats not being removable is also slightly annoying. Like, you can shove them all the way forward, but it takes a lot of tools. You gotta deactivate the side airbags as well. Otherwise, that poses a problem. So I ended up not taking them out to move stuff, just because it is such a hassle. That's one negative as far as minivans go. I mean, if you're using it for moving a lot of stuff, it's probably annoying for short periods of time. But I feel like most people that buy minivans probably want those seats up anyways, because they got kids and things to put back there. The actual driving of it, man, I really like this thing. I've been getting such good fuel economy. I've been basically doing like 3-5 mile stints back and forth between one house and another, because that's about how far I move from my current place. So nothing's better for city driving than a hybrid. Stuff it full, and it's, you know, it's just nice. I love all the brown leather in there. The faux wood trim is super convenient. It's just such an easy vehicle to drive. The one funny thing, I mean, this thing has every option goody in the bag. It's an expensive minivan. But like the cooled seats I've been using a lot here recently throughout the summer, and they're like jet planes taking off. Like, when you throw that cooled seat on, it's like you got the fans on kill everywhere throughout the car. Like, I've never heard a louder cooled seat in my life.
Yes,
which is a weird impression to have, but like I just felt like I had to throw that out there because they're so dang loud. I've certainly enjoyed my time in it. It's probably, I think it's my favorite minivan. I like driving it more than the Chrysler, more than the Honda. The Carnival is probably my favorite to look at still, but it's so tough to beat that hybrid fuel efficiency with it, and just the really, really great control panel and interior. I'm smitten with. If it just had that flat load floor, I think I'd love it. But as it is, I just really, really like it. So, okay. Yeah, Sienna.
Yeah, it's really. Those are two interesting observations. I drove this thing to Gulf Shores in the Florida Panhandle. It's been like 3-4 months ago. It was mid-spring, so I'm looking forward to another road trip. Going to take it to the UP. Put a lot of stuff in it. Like you, that kind of pass over like hump in the back, it's always a little bit of a pain to try to figure out like where you're going to put, like, you know. So I'm going to probably take a really big cooler and probably take my golf clubs, and the fishing poles will fit wherever because they go over the top. But still, it's like, yeah, it's kind of a weird thing, you know. And you can kind of get that extra compartment when you flip over the top, which gives you some space, but then there's a little bit of a trade-off there, you know.
Yeah,
so I do wish it was a little flatter. It's still like head and shoulders above most SUVs and crossovers just because of how big it is back there. That's super, you know, cavernous. You can just start stacking stuff and you don't even have to think. Whereas if you're in something, you know, like my wife's GMC Acadia, you know, it's, there's like the wheel wells, you have to think more and like what's going to go where. So, you know, net, it's a good thing, but yeah, it's a little annoying. Golf clubs are going to have to probably get propped somewhere weird. We'll figure that one out. And the cooler is always a challenge. loudest vents, I agree with you. And I've been in some cars with loud vents. The Grand Highlander, which I'll talk about next year, had very loud cooled seats. It sounds like you're in like a plane when they turn the like the air on before takeoff.
It's wild.
Yeah. No, it's weird. I don't know. Like, and the other thing, it's not like it's that cool either. Like, I didn't find myself in this like hyperbaric chamber, you know, where I'm like cooled off. So that's kind of a weird one. But I'm looking forward to getting some time in it. I imagine probably keep it for a couple few weeks. Then we'll trade it out again, as we do with these long-termers. Guess it'll probably get me into early September. So that's good. We'll do back to school. Maybe get through that for the first part.
Yeah.
That'll, you know, generate some content, if you will.
One more thing before we do transition to Grand Highlander. Yeah. In case you at home have a Sienna and you find yourself needing to move a first-gen Porsche Boxster hardtop,
yeah,
it does fit in the back of a Sienna.
That's a nice tease for the spend my money segment.
I know, yeah, exactly, right. But I know that's some niche content for you guys there. But I did that last night, and it fits like a glove. It's honestly.
Did you get a picture?
Oh yeah, of course.
Okay, good,
yeah,
good,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah. You could not. There's like half a centimeter on either side. You just put a little padding there, and boom, you can move your Boxster hardtop in the back of your Toyota Sienna. So
I think that is a great update right there. Yeah. Four paragraphs with a picture. I would totally read that. That is cool.
Exactly.
Cool. All right. Well, I don't know if you could get a, hard top of the back of the Hybrid Max Platinum Grand Highlander that I tested last week. I really liked it. This is kind of a weird place to go mentally, but with the reveal of the Land Cruiser, which I still had the Grand Highlander during, and the fact that it was a hybrid, this is the Grand Highlander, with the kind of like springy brakes, it kind of made me almost think, oh, it's like I'm driving the new large Toyota replacement for the Land Cruiser, which, no, it's not like the old school brakes of the 4Runner and the Land Cruiser. This is like the hybrid springy feeling, but it was enough to kind of get the thoughts flowing. And it does make a lot of sense when you think about it now, because now this one starts at 58. I had a very loaded up one. In the Grand Highlander is, of course, the three row one. The Hybrid XLE, that's more like 45-ish. You can get a base model, a base, an XLE for 43. So there's a bit of a spectrum here. Seven different models, if you will, on this, you know, on the Grand Highlander spectrum. The Hybrid Max was very nice. It was a, like kind of like a deep, I don't even know what to call it, but multiple people really enjoyed the color of it, which weird thing to talk about on a podcast because you can't see it. But if you're looking for like Grand Highlander, it's a pretty good color to take. It's kind of like a deep cobalt blue, if you will. So it's pretty nice. The thing was pretty loaded, as you would expect for 58. It had all sorts of things from LED lights, 20-inch wheels. You know, interior was pretty nice. It had that Toyota leather type thing they do. I assume it's actually real leather. There was some suede stuff going on. Infotainment was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, and then, you know, so you've got the Platinum, and then the Limited is like also quite loaded, if you will. So both models give you a ton of things here. Again, LED lights, leather, you get that infotainment system. You know, you even get like back row heated seats, that type of thing, which puts you at 54. So both solid premium type vehicles. You look at the, you know, if you just want the hybrid, you just want to step up to that, which I would argue you should probably do. When you look at some of these, the mileage discrepancies, you know, the Hybrid XLE, that's the base one, for 44,670, you're at 37 and 34 miles per gallon, which I think is very, very good. You know, with hybrids, you get a little better city mileage. That's why that number might sound a little weird. But to me, that's the move right there, is to do that. It was actually, I think this is my first taste of the Grand Highlander. I liked it. John Snyder actually, serendipitously, if you will, put up a buying guide at around the same time. So I was kind of checking that out at different points. So check that out too, if you're looking for more like Autoblog content on this. He liked it as well. So I think it tracks like his impressions, if you will. He called it expensive, which, fair, I get it. You know, it goes into a segment where there's a lot of like mainstream commodity brands that are trending premium, whether they're things that we know and like the Kia Telluride, Hyundai Palisade. The new Pilot's pretty good. So there's a lot of stuff in there, but offering this like hybrid powertrain, I think is a good, you know, value proposition for Toyota. I think it's, and as you expected, this is like, it's built off sort of like the Highlander. You didn't think they were going to screw this up. Like if you screw up a variant of the Highlander in your Toyota, you're really screwing things up. You know, that would be like Ford somehow screwing up, you know, an Explorer or something. So, I think people are going to like this. This is definitely like what people are looking for right now. As far as like, hey, you can get a pretty big vehicle with fuel economy up to 37 miles per gallon. You know, the only thing, like slight downside, Snyder noted this as well, again, is like, I definitely said it's a good value, but again, for $58,000, you could even get into like some like German level luxury. Maybe not quite as nice or quite as, because obviously you pay for it if you look at like a Mercedes or a BMW, but you can at least get into those brands for 58 grand. You may not want to be like, hey, got a $58,000 Toyota. You know, it's, you know, so something to think about. I was in some nice neighborhoods and I was kind of comparing different cars and I'm thinking, yeah, I bet this car costs more than this car over here, but nobody's going to care because it just looks like a kind of nice Toyota, you know? So different, and maybe you don't care about that either. That's the other thing, you know. So kind of my mini review of the Highlander, the Grand Highlander.
Yeah, and one aspect of that, to bring this back to Land Cruiser, because we talked a lot about Land Cruiser, like the one that you had, the Hybrid Max powertrain, that's very, very similar to the actual powertrain that's going to be in the new Land Cruiser. It's yeah, the same. It's a 2.4 liter turbocharged four cylinder combined with an electric motor. It's not the exact output figures. The Land Cruiser has slightly different torque figures, and it also has an 8-speed automatic instead of a 6-speed. in the Grand Highlander that you had, but very similar engine and electric motor tech that I think we're going to see there. So hopefully it was good. Hopefully it bodes well for the Land Cruiser.
Yeah. Makes sense. It's, Toyota has been trying to sort of clean up their SUV lineup, but I think they're getting there with, the different things they've been doing, and sort of lopping off the Land Cruiser has allowed them to reset the rest of it. So, all right, should we spend some money?
Well, let's spend it up.
I am a Porsche fan, but I am young and I do not have Porsche money yet. I want something that has characteristics of a Porsche, like great handling, feels fast, and track focused. I know it won't be the same level, so it would be ideal to get a car that could do some subtle track focused, that I could do some subtle track focused modifications to. Hate convertibles, and I need something I can drive in snowy conditions. So something like an MX-5 or Boxster isn't a good fit. Any suggestions? This comes to us from the Reddit Our Cars thread. That means if you're looking to get in to spend some money, that's podcast@autoblog.com. We have some openings right now. Send them in. Get them in there. This is interesting. It's a little bit of contrarian in some ways, because on one hand, 20 to 30,000, you actually do have Porsche money. It's a used Porsche, but you can get that. But you also have the snowy conditions. So that's a little tricky too. You said a Gen 1 Boxster, if I recall right, owner. And I don't know if you want to tell us the price or not, that's fine, or give us a range. But you can do this, basically. Like, you basically did this. The trick is you probably just don't want to drive it in early January in Michigan. So, yeah, what would you do here, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, so if you're willing to go used, you can get yourself into a first-gen Porsche Cayman. I mean, he said he hates convertibles, so All right, don't buy the Boxster. Granted, I own a Boxster. I've owned it for, almost a whole year now. I love it. If I could convince you to like convertibles, I would tell you to go buy that. But whatever. We have the Cayman. I actually have a friend that just sold a Cayman, first gen Cayman S. You can totally get one in this $20,000 to $30,000 range, and you can get a pretty nice one too. It'll be decent miles, well taken care of, maybe even a decent enough color, and it's mid-engine. You can put some winter tires on that thing, and it will go in the winter. I can guarantee that. I'm sure that you've driven them in the winter too, Greg. A 911, a Cayman, like whatever. Like you have the weight over that rear axle. You have the right tires on it, and you can really get through some snow. And if you live somewhere like Buffalo, or that gets insane snow, maybe it's not the greatest choice, and you really need the ground clearance. But for the most part, like, you can probably get through like 98-99% of winter with a used Cayman on winter tires. Now, if you're not willing to go used, you're saying you don't have Porsche money, so maybe you do want something newer. I would definitely just go get yourself a BRZ or a GR86. Very similar idea. It's a two-door rear-wheel drive coupe, and it is super lightweight, and it will still go in the snow if you need it to, and it'll also be great on the track. So you can get that in the manual, and there are mods aplenty if that's what you want. And I should also mention, obviously there's mods aplenty for the Cayman too, if you really want to throw some money at that. So Cayman, I mean, you love Porsches, go buy that Cayman, take some risks. You might have to pay some in maintenance and all that, but it'll probably be worth it to you. What do you got, Greg?
Yeah, first of all, I really like older Porsches, especially ones that are like used, maybe not quite vintage, but they're drivers. So I always want to sort of confirm that bias, if that's what you're thinking. Slap on some snow tires. Depends on where you live too. Like if you live in Baltimore, where maybe it snows a couple times, you're going to be okay. If you're in Calgary, it's a different story, right? So you kind of got to maybe know how your winters are going to be as far as like just how severe they are. But I think like what you laid out is definitely a good option. If you want to try something a little bit different, this is going to be a little bit more pricey for you, but you could get like a 2018 Volkswagen Golf R. That'll come in. I'm seeing one on Edmunds for about 36. So that's just a little bit over, like 5 yards over, if you will, as far as your 20 to 30,000 range. I don't know how flexible that is. It's all wheel drive. I would still slap snow tires on that because it's kind of a small car. And, you know, all-wheel drive only does so much. But, you know, all-wheel drive Golf R in the winter, I think you'll be okay. I've driven a Golf R in the winter in the snow in February. I did a video shoot of it, and it was okay, you know. So I think that could be fun. Could be a good track car, obviously, you know, Golf R. Have some fun with that. So that's just another take on it. I tend to think Porsche is sort of the right answer here, but this is a, I would say, different approach. If you want to try something, you get something a little bit newer. I bet if you search hard enough and you're willing to take some miles and go back a few years, you could get this into your price range. So another idea to consider. And it's not a convertible, which is obviously a deal breaker here for the writer.
Yeah, no, I certainly like the idea of a Golf R. I guess any sort of all-wheel drive thing in that range would work too. I don't know if you're a WRX guy, but hey,
yeah,
it's a horizontally opposed engine. If you're after that, you know, there's a Porsche, there's a WRX, similar orientation.
Yeah,
but
that's another good one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously those things are crazy money used. So maybe you can even find one new for that price. And hey, the new one is, maybe you don't like the way it looks, but it rocks to drive. It is super, super fun.
Another car that I kind of forgot came with all-wheel drive is the Mazda 3. So that could be fun on track. You know, again, it doesn't look like all-wheel drive is totally like an absolute thing on here. I'm kind of inferring that, but I'm also trying to extrapolate what would be practical in the winter. You could get one of those in the early, low to mid 20s. So, especially if you even take a slightly used one, which, you know, good luck, I guess, either way, slightly new, slightly used, it's tough in this market, but that's a fun car. I happen to think it's very good looking. So something else to consider. Again, maybe slap some snow tires on that and away you go. Happy sledding.
And there is an aftermarket community for it. We have a Mazda 3 in our driveway right now. It's not an all-wheel drive one. But if you go do Mazda Cork Sport, they make a lot of stuff for that car. And you can turn it into, I wouldn't call it a full Mazda speed, but you can definitely make it a lot more sporty and aggressive than it came from the factory.
All right. Sounds good. So that's all the time we have this week. If you enjoy the show, please give us 5 stars on the Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show. Send us your Spend My Monies, or hey, we sometimes do a mailbag. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there, and we will see you next week.